Rishus Damar Da'asra, Rabbi Alman, the Director Emeritus of Just One Life, Rabbi Martin Kantz, President Director, Rabbi Tokea, Ronan Brabanan Brabaisai. And certainly the Achsanya for tonight is this very special organization, Just One Life. And as I've said in years past, it would seem that it's a skula to be zeichet to chayim in order to be able to cause chayim. And therefore, I urge everyone to open up their hearts and their wallets on behalf of this very choshev etztoche, Just One Life. I decided several months ago that the topic that I would use to talk about this year for the Tshuva Drasha would be the economic crisis that this country faces, and if there are any lessons that we can learn from this economic meltdown. When I first wrote the first version of this speech in August, this was the next sentence. Perhaps no single event symbolizes the economic crisis that we face as the collapse of Bear Stearns. However, since then, unfortunately, there are too many examples that now can be used instead of Bear Stearns. There's Fannie Mae, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, AIG, Washington Mutual, and of late, Wachovia. Nevertheless, I will still use Bear Stearns as the paradigm of what I want to speak about tonight. In case you don't know, Bear Stearns was one of the oldest and most prestigious investment banking firms on Wall Street. In its 86-year-old history, it did not have a single losing quarter until when it failed. Bear Stearns existed on a Friday afternoon, and by the time the next Monday came along, Bear Stearns was out of business. I know someone who worked for Bear Stearns for 20 years, and even though he was offered a job with J.P. Morgan when it took over Bear Stearns, he decided to take some time out of his life and to join a kailo in Teaneck, New Jersey. He gave a talk, which has been widely circulated, entitled From Bear Stearns to Bava Metzia. Here is his CV, so you have an idea of who this fellow is. I was on Wall Street for 25 years, including 20 years at Bear Stearns. I had some great calls and made people a lot of money. I was on the Institutional Investor All-Star Team for 16 years and on the Wall Street Journal All-Star Team for 9 years. This was not your garden variety, run-of-the-mill investment banker. This was a superstar. In that speech that he gave entitled Bear Stearns to Bava Metzia, he outlined 5 lessons of what he learned from the collapse of Bear Stearns. I would just like to share with you 1 or 2 of those lessons. Here's his first lesson. Every cost has a benefit, and every benefit has a cost. Wall Street is a great place to have a career, especially from a financial standpoint. Moreover, there is prestige associated with Wall Street and the power, etc., etc. What's wrong with that? The man continues, but there is a cost to being on Wall Street and probably in other high-powered positions, and that is you lose track of your priorities. The Gemara says in Bava Basra that Olam Hafach Ra'isi, which means that after we leave this world, we see that the world is inverted from this world. That was a hard Gemara for me to understand until I left the high-powered world. In that world, what you think is important loses its importance. The things I feared losing the most were the small things, the secretary, the black limousine town car waiting for me at my beck and call, and the things that you give up the easiest are time. Time with your family, quality time, quantity time, which are the things that I realized have the most value. Perhaps by now you're beginning to wonder what on earth does this have to do with Yom Kippur? The answer to that question lies in that one statement from his speech, and that is to repeat, But there is a cost to being on Wall Street, and that is you lose track of your priorities. Let me explain. One of the most unique aspects of the Day of Yom Kippur, which is the most unique day of the Jewish calendar, is the korban called the Sor HaMishtaleach. At the time that the Beis HaMikdash was standing, there was one goat that was chosen to symbolically bear the sins of all of Klal Yisrael. It was pushed off a cliff in the Judean desert. There is no other korban like this. There is no Mizbeach, there is no Shechita, there is no Zrika. In fact, the source of the English word scapegoat, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is from here. Even stranger, some Mefarshim associate this goat, this Sa'ir, with Esav of all people. And it is no coincidence that the word in Hebrew for goat, Sa'ir, is in fact how Esav is referred to several times in the Chumash as the Ish Sa'ir. To explain this connection between Esav and the Sa'ir, the Klal Yakar in Chumash suggests that is because Esav is partially responsible for all the averis that we as a Klal Yisrael commit. V'chein Esav, writes the Klal Yakar, kol mizimasam, the entire purpose of Esav and the forces of Esav, lahachatiyas Yisrael. And therefore, writes the Klal Yakar, it is only right that Esav, represented by this Sa'ir, should bear the burden of the sins of Klal Yisrael. But what does that mean? What does Esav have to do with it? Why is Esav to blame? But it was even more mysterious and even scarier that there was a designated person who took out this carbon from Yerushalayim and pushed it off this cliff in the Judean desert. That person is referred to in the Torah as the Ish Iti, the designated person. But Chazal say a very, very scary thing about that person. Every year, the person that took out the Sor HaMishtaleach was a person that was going to die in that year. Now, why is that so? Why, of all people, do we need someone who's going to die to be the one that takes out the Sor HaMishtaleach? To try to grasp all of this, I want to share with you part of a shmuz that was once given by Rav Matasio Solomon Shlita. But in order to appreciate this, we have to return to the famous story of Yaakov and Esav, a story that began even before they were born. The Tana de Bei Eliyahu discusses a conversation that Yaakov and Esav have while they're still in their mother's womb, in utero. The Tana Bei Eliyahu writes, Yaakov says to his brother, Shnei Olam Yesh Lefaneinu. There are two worlds. Ha'olam hazeh v'ha'olam haba, this world and the world to come. Ha'olam hazeh yesh bo yachila v'shtia, this is a world of eating and drinking. Masa u'matan, it's a world of business. Lo'seis isha l'ha'oli banim u'banais, to marry a woman and to have children. Aval olam haba, einei kein b'chol hamidas halalu. Olam haba has nothing of the like. Olam haba is a world that's totally spiritual. Nothing physical, nothing material. This is the world of eating and drinking, wives and children, money and possessions. Not olam haba. Yaakov says to his brother Esav, Esav, I'll make you a deal. You take olam hazeh, you take this world, and I'll take olam haba, and I'll take the world to come, the world of the spiritual. Esav says to Yaakov, deal. Minayin shekachu, and when did that deal consummate? Shenemar michra kayayim is b'chayras chali. On the day that Esav sold the birthright, the firstborn, the right of the firstborn to Yaakov, that's when this deal came into being. Now, fast forward 60 years later. Yaakov comes back from the house of his father-in-law, Lavan. He has four wives and a dozen children, and he has tzayin and bukkar, and he has tons and tons of possessions and cattle and riches. And Esav looks at this entire scene and he says to him, Omar le Esav le Yaakov ochi le kach omar to li shetito la to oilem abo. Yaakov, what happened to the deal? said you're going to take the world to gum. And what are all these wives and these children? What are all these possessions? What are all these riches? What happened to the deal, Yaakov? To which Yaakov responds and he says, Omar Loi, Haruchush Shenosan Li HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Shamshei Li B'Olam Hazeh. He says to him, Esav, you don't understand. Yes, sir, these are physical possessions, but the purpose and the tachlis of all of these possessions are to help me get my Olam Haba. They are not an end in and of themselves. They are merely tools. It's a mean to be zeichet to Olam Haba. And therefore, in spite of the fact that you have all of these physical things, this isn't Olam Hazeh. Olam Hazeh is when you use all of this for its own sake. Possessions for possession's sake. Money for money's sake. Women for women's sake. But if you use that for a higher purpose, if you use that to complete your mission, the world to come, that's not Olam Hazeh. That's Olam Haba. They are mere means to a higher end. And here in Yaakov Avinu articulates what the Hashkofas HaTaira, what Judaism feels about how we view the possessions of this world. Judaism is not a religion of ascetics. We are not a bunch of nuns and monks that have nothing to do with this world. We don't abstain from the physical. As long as they don't become a means in and of themselves. But rather, means in the completion of our mission on this earth. It is when they become the purpose of our lives. When pleasure and possessions become a goal in their own right. That is when one ceases to live the life of Yaakov and begins to live the life of Esav. Esav represents the life of the Epicurean, where their pleasure and possessions are indeed the goal. That's Esav. That's not Yaakov. But what invariably happens to most of us is that we become enthralled with this world of Esav. And we get caught up in the pursuit of pleasures and possessions for their own right. We lose our focus on what's eager and what's tuffle, on what's primary and what's secondary, what's major and what's minor. And on a metaphysical level, this is what Esav tries to do to each and every one of us. To lure us into his world and to get caught up in this rat race. Let me give you a mussel. When our oldest child was about 14 or 15 months old, we bought him his first Hanukkah present. It was a truck. I was learning in Kailal. My wife was teaching in Beis Yaakov. We did not have a lot of money, but it's his first Hanukkah present. So we bought the truck, and my wife wrapped it, and we light the first Hanukkah licht, and we give the box to Yaakov. I say, Yaakov, let's open the box. And we take away the wrapping, and we open the box, and we take out the truck. And what does Yaakov play with? He plays with the box. Yaakov, the box didn't cost me $20. Play with the eker. Don't play with the tuffle. But that's what happens to us. We get caught up in the packaging. And we lose sight and lose focus of what we're here for. We forget what's the prize. And what's the packaging? I know a rabbi, good friend of mine in the rabbinate, that was counseling a couple, high-powered couple. Both of them had very, very demanding jobs that would keep them away till 7, 8, 9 o'clock every single night. They had a nanny for their child and their children. And every night the children would watch at the window until mommy and daddy came home. And when the rabbi asked them, "Why are you doing that?" the standard answer was, "We're doing it for the good of the children. To be able to give them everything that they can need in life. Everything except parents who are involved in their daily lives." They made the same mistake that the Bnei God and the Bnei Ruvain made when they were about to come into Eretz Yisrael. The Bnei God and the Bnei Ruvain come to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, "We'll take this side of the Yarden." Let us build corrals for our cattle. And cities for our children. And Moshe Rabbeinu hears that statement and he says to him, "Rabbi Sai, you have it backwards. You're putting your cattle, your possessions before your children. That's not the way it works. You got it backwards. Now let me ask you, Bnei God and Bnei Ruvain, the descendants of God and Ruvain, you think that they were so wrong that they were thinking more about their cattle than their children? Is there any Jewish parent that thinks more about his possessions than his children? Of course not. But is that we make that mistake? We're doing it for the good of the children. But we get it backwards. We get farchapt by this world. We get farchapt by Esav." You know, my Rosh Shiva, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Rav Ruderman, always used to say at a Pidyon HaBen, at a Pidyon HaBen, the father of the firstborn son goes to the Kayin and makes the Pidyon HaBen, and the Kayin asks him a question which has to be the quintessential rhetorical question. And that is, "My Boyistveh, what do you want more? Your firstborn son, Bincha Becherecha, or the Chamei Shloim, or the $5? I don't think in the history of humanity there's ever been a father that said, "You keep the kid, I'll take the $5. Certainly not for a firstborn. My Rashiva used to say, "My boy is tvei." That's not a question only to pick it up in. That's a question for life. Because invariably there are going to come conflicts between your money or your children, by how you live your life, by what city you decide to live in, by what neighborhood you decide to be in. My boy is tvei. What do you want more? You want that addition to your house? And you won't be able to pay to have a bachur learn with your son in yeshiva. And that's not a theoretical case. I know of such a case. A person built an addition, and then when he was asked to find an older chavrusa for his son, he said, "I can't afford it. My boy is tvei." That's what life is all about. A series of questions. Ruchnius versus Gashmius. Olam Hazeh versus Olam Haba. The life of Yaakov, the life of Esav. I gave this speech in Great Neck, New York several weeks ago, which is a community of Iranian Jews. And a young fellow came up to me afterwards and says, "I'm glad you gave that speech because you validated a decision that I just made on Friday. I just finished my residency in internal medicine. I want to become a gastroenterologist, but it's a very competitive field. and it's hard to get a residency. And I told my advisor that I will only apply to cities in which they have large Jewish communities, because I have to be in a Jewish community. I cannot take a residency in Pocatello, Idaho. And the advisor said to the doctor, this young man, she said, can't you put your religion on hold for 3 years? My boy is Tve. You tend to lose sight of what's the Yik and what's the Tuffle. The Tuffle takes over our lives. And it's in all types of areas. For instance, people do construction on their houses. There's nothing wrong with that. People, families grow. Quarters become crowded. You modernize. Gesunte Heit. But then, with the best of intentions, things sort of get out of hand. And then the upgrades begin. And we bandy about the expression of, well, once we're doing it, granite is so prosaic, can't we do something better? You see people accompanied by their husbands, their mothers, their decorators, poring over samples with anguished looks on their face, peering at mosaic tiles for the bathroom. The urgency in which people talk about window treatments. You know, when I was growing up, you either put shades on your windows, curtains on your windows, drapes on your windows, Venetian blinds. Treatments. Are the windows sick that they need treatment? I know a woman who went to an upholsterer looking new fabric for her dining room chairs. When she told the customer, when she told the upholsterer that she was, quote, nervous about a certain fabric because she doesn't love it, the upholsterer deadpanned and said, you don't need to love it, and material should never make you nervous. Or the new imperative, the must-have pocketbook, the must-have pair of boots, the must-have knapsack for your children's, for your two or second graders' school supplies. The must-have. But the most egregious example is the woman who commented about the bugaboo. Now you have to pardon me. I'm a country bumpkin from Baltimore, Maryland. It's a backwater of a city. I didn't know what a bugaboo was. But apparently a bugaboo is the Mercedes-Benz of baby strollers. And when this woman saw a bugaboo, she said, I have to have another baby so I can get, I can buy a bugaboo. Guess what? Just get the bugaboo. Forget about the baby. Misplaced priorities don't only affect Gashmius, but we forget what's the Yik and what's the Tuffle. I'm not here to discourage people from getting involved in chesed organizations and bikur chaylims and mikvos and beis yakovs. Do not walk out of here and say, Rabbi Fran said, you shouldn't do these things. But listen to what one woman wrote. It is crucial to remember what a woman's with children's primary role is, and that's a mother. If she can successfully juggle both the involvement in chesed outside the home and the needs of her children, then all the power to her. However, the downside is illustrated by the case of a woman on the phone for hours arranging food for needy families, with one of her children pulling on her skirt. Finally, in exasperation, she says to her child, "Can't you stop bothering me? I'm trying to make sure that people have food." At which point the child says, "But Mommy, I'm hungry." We've become such a trivial society. Society that's so consumed in chitzonius and externals, in trappings. That's part of the problem with shiduchim. We forget what really matters. I know a woman who called up a man to ask about a bachur. The bachur is a baal tshuva who's in medical school. Her first question was, does he wear a white shirt or a colored shirt? Now, sometimes white shirts and colored shirts are indicative. But a baal tshuva in medical school? And you're worried about a blue shirt? I mean, I wish I had the guts sometimes to say this to people when they ask me such ridiculous questions on the phone. But the man said to her, "He's a lady. Are you not care? Do you, does it bother you? Do you want to know whether he's a mensch? Whether he knows how to learn? Whether he's a Yirei Shamayim? All you want to know is, what color shirt does the guy wear?" Or the woman who said, when looking for a future daughter-in-law for her second son, "I will never get a girl who's a scraper." Scraper? You don't know what scraper is. I don't know what scraper was either. A scraper apparently is the girl who has the audacity and is so uncouth that she scrapes the plates at the dining room table. "And I will not take a scraper." Talk about misplaced priorities. Now, this summer I was in South Africa. And I asked them if they could take me to Victoria Falls, which is one of the 7 natural wonders of the world. So they were kind enough to take me to, of all places, Zimbabwe, which no person in their right mind really should go to, but that's another kasha. So we're there driving in Zimbabwe, which is a country that is destitute, a country that people don't have gas. It's mind-boggling. So I'm driving there with our guide, and we see what you see very often in Africa: women carrying things on the top of their head. I saw a woman must have been carrying a 20-pound bag of oranges on the top of her head, walking for miles and miles, balancing this on the top of her head. So I said to the driver, I said, "Wow, you know." He says, "What do you mean? There are people that will not take a woman as a son, as a daughter-in-law, unless she can walk and balance things on her head?" I thought to myself, wait till this gets back to Brooklyn. But the emissaries, they're right. And walking and balancing thing on your head is a necessary skill. Because you have to do that in Africa. And that makes a lot more sense than the shtuyot, the trivialities and the externals that we get caught up in. And all these misplaced priorities is because we fall prey to the allure of Esav. we lose the battle that began with Yaakov and Esav and their fundamental difference of how to view this world. The difference that began with that discussion in the womb that was finalized on the day that Esav sold the Bechira and reached its apogee on that night of that epic battle between Yaakov Avinu and the Sarai Shal Esav, the archangel of Esav. When Esav thought he finally has Yaakov. And that Yaakov has succumbed to this world. For after all, didn't he go back for Pach and Tanim for a few vessels? This is my chance, Esav said. What Esav did not realize is Tzadikim is Memonim Chaviv Aleim Yeshem Yikufon. Vayar Kilo Yocholoi. He couldn't conquer Yaakov because Yaakov was immune to this. But Vayiga Bekaf Yerech Yaakov. He hid in his support. He hid it in the Yerech. He hid in the Yetzi Harotzav. He hid him in his descendants. And we became afflicted and infected. And from that moment on, the die had been cast. And the forces of Esav will forever try to distract us from our purpose in the world and lose focus of why we were sent here. And that is what the Kli Yochor means when the Kli Yochor says that so many of our Averis are the fault of Esav. Because he chaps us. Because he tempts us. And we take the bait. And it is why the Torah gave us the Sar HaMishtaleach, that goat that we send off every year. But merely using Esav as a scapegoat alone won't work. Tshuva is not that simple. But that is what Yom Kippur is for. Yom Kippur is to sit there in shul without the distractions, without the telephone, without the cell phone, without all of the distractions, and to think about the direction of our lives and dedicate ourselves to why we were sent here. We are the most fortunate nation on the face of the earth. Ashrei ha'am shekach alai, Ashrei ha'am shehashem aleikov. Baruch aleikenu shebaranu lichvaydai. V'hivdilanu min hatayim. Who separated us from the world that is crazy. V'nosan lanu teras emes. A day to contemplate what's important and what's trivial. Most of the world doesn't have such an opportunity. And it takes something traumatic to get people to re-examine their lives. To our friend from Bear Stearns, it was the collapse of that company. And the lesson that he derived is one of the most overarching themes of Yom Kippur. And that is you lose track of your priorities. We shouldn't need an economic collapse for us to focus on what's important. Because we have the most glorious day of the year. Yom Kippur. For another man, it took more than the collapse of his business. It took a fatal disease. His name was Professor Randy Pausch. Maybe that name rings a bell because he wrote a best-selling book that's been translated into several different languages. Randy Pausch was a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. And it has become the custom of universities to ask professors to give what's called the last lecture. A lecture in which the professor gets up in front of his students and his colleagues and he tries to impart to them the lessons that he has learned in this world as this, though this would be his last lecture. Randy Pausch didn't have to imagine that this would be his last lecture, because he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, Loyalenu. And by the time he got up to give the lesson, the lecture, he knew he only had several months to live. He had a dilemma, which I found to be the most interesting part of the book. Truth be told, I'm not here to give book reviews, but the book itself I did not find meaningful at all. The lessons, I think, are basic, especially to every Yid. But the dilemma that he had of whether he should give the lecture, because it would take so much time to prepare the lecture, time that he would not have with his wife and children. And time was all of a sudden so precious that maybe it wasn't worthwhile to prepare and to give that lecture because it would take away time from his family. In the end, he decided to give the lecture so it would be videotaped and his children, who were the young at the time, would be able to see the lecture and to see what their father was about. But there's one sentence in the entire book that I found meaningful. And that is the following. Life is about the importance of overcoming obstacles, of enabling the dreams of others, of seizing every moment. Because time is all you have. And you may find out one day that you have less of it than you think. At his death, his wife commented and said, "Randy was so happy and proud that the lecture in the book inspired parents to revisit their priorities, particularly their relationship with their children." Jews should not need a last lecture to crystallize in our minds what's important and what is not. Because we have Yom Kippur. And now we can understand why the Ish Iti, that designated man, is a person that's going to die in that year. Because the Soir HaMishtaleach is all about renouncing the world of Esav. The Sor HaMishtaleach is about remembering what's important and what's trivial. The Sor HaMishtaleach is about dedicating our lives to the life of Yaakov Avinu, of Olam Haba, of Ruchnius. And who better to do that than a man who knows the meaning and the preciousness of life, because he's going to die in that year. He understands what matters in this world and what doesn't. And now we can understand the enigmatic words of a Zohar. The Zohar writes on the Pasuk, "Vayoshav b'yayim ahu Esav l'darkai." On that day, after that meeting between Yaakov and Esav, when he came back from Lavan with all of his possessions, on that Pasuk of Vayoshav b'yayim ahu, writes the Zohar, "Vayoshav b'yayim ahu Esav l'darkai, Emosai." When does Esav go back? Bishas ne'ila. That's when Esav departs. It happens every year on Yom Kippur, precisely at the time of Ne'ila. But why? To where? What does Esav have to do with Yom Kippur? And why precisely at Ne'ila? And the answer is because Ne'ila is the most unique tefillah of that unique day. We say things in Ne'ila that we don't say by Shacharis Mincha Ma'ariv. We say a tefillah called Atanes in Yad LaPeshim. And twice in the course of the Ne'ila we say these words, L'ma'nechtal mi'oshek yodenu. That the whole purpose of Yom Kippur is that we should stop stealing. Let us return to you that we draw our hands from theft. Is that your problem? Your problem is theft? You're a ganef? Have you ever been caught shoplifting? That's our problem? Nechtal miyayshek yadenu from Gezel? The answer is that Gezel is only the symptom of an underlying sickness. A sickness that has to do with this obsession with this world and its possessions. That leads us sometimes to cut corners, to push the envelope, and sometimes to even engage in illegalities that it becomes theft. Why? Because we so are reingetan and so obsessed and so preoccupied with money and possessions and things that it can ultimately lead to theft. But it is the illness of Esav, that's behind this. And that is what the Zohar means. When does Esav depart? When does Esav leave us? When do we rid ourselves of the influence of Esav? Bishas Nila. I just want to end with a shmooze. Several lines of a shmooze that were given in this city, in Brooklyn, New York, by Reb Chatzkel Levenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. In case you don't know, Reb Chatzkel Levenstein was the mashkiach in the yeshiva in Mir in Poland. He traveled with the yeshiva through Russia, across Russia, to Kobe, to Shanghai, and he was the glue that held the Mir yeshiva together. After the war, for a short time, he was here in Brooklyn until he went to Yerushalayim and became the mashkiach in the Mir Yerushalayim, and then became the mashkiach in the Panevichi yeshiva. But he was here for a short time, and he gave a shmooze to American Bachurim in the yeshiva in Mir in Brooklyn, just down the street. And in that yeshiva, in that shmooze, he talked about Hollywood. Now, the word Hollywood and Reb Chatzkel Levenstein should never be found in the same sentence. Because if there was one man who was so rachik from Hollywood, it was him. He's the closest thing that I ever read about of a malach b'tzuras adam. But this is what he said. I heard that there's a place in America where there are actors and actresses who are the richest, most materialistic, self-indulgent people in America. But they die like everyone else. And usually at their funerals, someone stands before the grave and delivers a eulogy. What do these types say when they stand before an open grave at their funeral of one of their own? Do they proclaim how handsome or how rich he was, how beautiful or how brilliant she was, how many houses and boats did they own? No. In the history of the world, no one ever stood by an open grave and proclaimed how beautiful or how wealthy the deceased was. They say that he was kind to his parents, And though he became wealthy, he still remembered his childhood friends. They say how he helped the poor, the ill, the homeless, and the unfortunate. Because before an open grave, Sheker closes its mouth for a very few minutes, and the emes comes out. When this happens, every person in the world will say, the only true and valuable things in a person's lifetime are his acts of kindness. That's what they say about us. We won't be remembered for the cars we had, the square footage of our homes, the deals that we did. We want to be remembered by what type of parents we were to our children, but what type of children we were to our parents. What type of people we were to our friends and neighbors. The chesed that we did, the Torah that we learned, the Torah that we taught. That's the legacy that we want to leave behind. And that is what Yom Kippur is for. For redirection, for introspection, dedicating our lives to the lives of Yaakov. We are, after all, the Bnei Yaakov, the Bnei Esav. Let us try to live up to that glorious legacy of the Saba Kadisha, our Zeta, Yaakov Avinu. Gmar Chesima Tovah.